Case for argument, United States v. Vitrano. Mr. Rosen.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Mark Rosen appears on behalf of the defendant, appellant Thomas Vitrano. I think it's pretty clear from the law that the in-state government's introduction of Exhibits X, Y, and Z, which led to Exhibit 9, which were the two phone calls, which were really extremely crucial to the government's case because they were the only government evidence that actually had my client's voice on it, as opposed to Scott Bologna, did not, A, violate the Confrontation Clause, and, B, Judge Adelman's theory was that it came in as a chain of custody issue. And it's our position that it didn't meet a chain of custody issue standard anyway. But I don't think we even need to get to that, because I think it's pretty clear that it was a violation of the Confrontation Clause. The person that actually did the work, and this whole body of new case law that's been coming out, culminating, I think, most recently with what the government calls Turner 2, the U.S. versus Danny Turner, the second one, which came out after People versus Williams, clearly indicates that in a case like this, where you have a person who does the work, you have to have that person. Otherwise, it's a violation of the Confrontation Clause. Turner very clearly stated,
what work did this person do?
This person was able to analyze the tapes, look at the tapes, figure it out, and then basically put together what the work was.
What kind of analysis did the person do?
We don't know. We don't know what he did. I think when you couple that with the chain of custody requirements for recordings, competency of the operator, whether or not there were alterations in the tapes, whether or not the recording equipment was given in a proper, was properly working, none of that came out. And I think Turner clearly stated the jury didn't have the opportunity. There was no
process. What do you mean none of it came out? Are you saying a chain of custody case, everybody in the chain of custody has to testify?
No. And that's a very good point, Your Honor. I think, I discussed that in my reply brief, there are certain, and Melendez-Diaz talked about that, where you have certain witnesses in a chain of custody case who are crucial to the chain of custody, such as here where you have the technician. It's one thing to have
They're all crucial.
Well, but there's levels of crucialness.
And I don't understand that. If the chain is broken at any link, it's no good, right?
Well, it would, as the courts have indicated, it goes to weight, not admissibility, but certain, as this court indicated in Far Out, when you have a chain of custody issue with a person that's actually doing the initial work, you have to have standards, which is the voice recording, where you have to be able to meet a reliability threshold to meet admissibility. And that's what this Court of Appeals said in Far Out. It's one thing to say, I'm taking it from here and putting it in a safe. Just as an intermediate guy, you can maybe admit that. But the person that's actually doing the work, taking the work, doing that, that is a different level of...
Well, what type of work is he doing?
He was basically doing something to get tapes. We don't know what they were, to identify phone calls. We don't know how he was doing it, whether or not the machines were working, what he did, whether it was altered. We don't know.
But that's the old chain of custody argument. When we bring in a technician to do that type of thing and let somebody else analyze it.
Correct. The thing is that I think the case law says, both on a confrontation clause and a chain of custody, you have to have the technician come in. The government is the proponent of this evidence. They're the ones who have to meet the reliability threshold. You have to have the technician come in and say, this is working, this is what I did, this is how I did it, this is what I eliminated, these are my qualifications, my criteria, what I've got going on. There were no false alterations, nothing was done wrong. And that was not done here. They just put on this Lieutenant Fardell, who was basically some sort of overall supervisor and investigated supervisor for gang activities, and basically took subpoenas and then gave them on to somebody else. And that is basically the end line. He comes in and testifies.
How is this testimony, Mr. Rosen, how is this testimony testimonial in the way that word is used in the Supreme Court's Williams case?
You mean the technician, Your Honor?
The testimony that was absent, yeah, the proffered.
Well, it was testimonial.
I'm
sorry, Your Honor?
Testimony you would have wanted to have heard, yeah.
Well, because I think it goes to the same standards that you meet with Turner, Melendez-Diaz, that whole People versus Williams. This is the person that did the work which led to the evidence that was presented at trial. This wasn't investigative a work. This was work that was designed to prepare for testimony at trial. This was trial work. It was testimonial, just like a certificate. A lab technician does work to prepare an OWI, as like from my recollection, Melendez-Diaz. They do the work. They prepare a certificate. Well, the certificate isn't good enough because it's the work that the technician does that leads to the ultimate conclusion as to what came out at trial.
Now, the other party to that conversation testified in open court. Is that right?
That's correct. Mr. Valona.
What is the significance of that to your argument?
Well, it came after the fact. By this time, the government had already introduced it, had already admitted that evidence. It's important. It did supposedly identify Mr. Vetrona. Mr. Valona had some serious issues about his credibility, but it still doesn't answer the requirements of Farrakh, which says you have to still, it's just one factor. You still have to be able to identify were there material or alterations in the tapes, was the competency of the operator, was the equipment working at the time? Those are all factors. So this is maybe one piece of the puzzle, but it's clearly not the total puzzle, and it came after the admission had already occurred. So basically this was just after the fact. It was.
Your client maintained that there were other phone calls other than the ones that were presented?
I didn't handle this at trial. My recollection is my client did not testify. My client's position was that this was not him. Essentially, Mr. Valona did this, that this was not him. I don't remember if there was any issues about this. This was the government's evidence. They got exhibits Y and Z together, and then they had their police officer, Adamson, put together and called the two phone calls for their case in chief. So I don't know if he admitted that or not, but it was their burden of proof. And So I think the case law clearly shows that it did not meet the standards of Confrontation Clause or the chain of custody arguments. I'll save the time for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Rosen. Mr. Giampietro?
Good morning. May it please the Court, Counsel. Gordon Giampietro on behalf of the United States. I'm prepared to rest on the briefs in this case. I don't think there is a Confrontation Clause problem here initially because I don't think there's a statement that was admitted through any of the witnesses at trial.
Let me ask you a question about this. So this technician, so he has Vetrano's unique number. And so what does he do? He types that into a computer and presses a button? Is that what's
going on? Yes, Your Honor. The way this works, and Lieutenant Fardell, who was the supervisor of the unit that responds to subpoenas, explained this in his trial testimony, that each individual inmate has a specific number assigned to them. He delegated to the technician to search the computer system for that particular number, and that's exactly what the technician did, according to Lieutenant Fardell. That resulted in two CDs being provided to the government, were marked for...
So the technician is not actually listening... He's just pressing the button to collect Vetrano's phone calls.
That's correct, Your Honor. He really is not an individual who's out of court who gave some opinion about whether this is or is not Mr. Vetrano's voice on the tape. So he's not at all someone that falls
He's not vouching for whatever comes up.
Absolutely not. And that's why there really isn't even a statement here for purposes of the hearsay rules, much less a statement that would be potentially testimonial and then subject to Crawford. So neither of those things even occurred in this case. And just for the record, in terms of how this came before the jury, the CDs that were received from the Bureau of Prisons were marked for identification purposes as Y and Z. They were not introduced into evidence. They were simply marked. From those two CDs, Exhibit 9 was created by the agent in the case. Those two phone calls were played for the jury. They were conditionally admitted properly by the district judge with the ATF agent on the stand who created that exhibit, and then they were perfectly authenticated by Mr. Valona when he testified in court. And I think what the defense is confusing here are the two different methods of authentication. And we of course know that issues of chain of custody go to weight, not admissibility. That's a state court concept in Wisconsin. It's not the rule in federal court. There are two ways to get recordings into evidence. One is if you're not a party to the conversation, there has to be a foundation as to the reliability of the mechanical device that captured the conversation. The alternative is to have someone who is a part of the conversation say, I'm familiar with the voice that you're hearing, that's me, and the other person is the defendant in this case. So we really sort of had both methods of authentication in this case, purposes of laying the foundation to put it into evidence. I still am mystified by why there's a Crawford problem here, because there's not a statement. You know, Crawford starts out with this principle that you may satisfy the hearsay rules for purposes of admissibility, but you have a constitutional problem if this is a testimonial statement. We don't even have a statement here. The testimony about what this technician did wasn't what he said, wasn't any analysis that he did. It's just that he punched into the computer system this unique number and pulled those and gave them to Lieutenant Fardell. So there's not a constitutional problem. There isn't even an evidentiary problem. There's no statement. There are two aspects of the reply brief that I need to respond to because obviously I haven't had a chance to. The citation of this court's decision in Farad, if that's how you pronounce it, at pages 2 and 4, the defense seizes on that because that's a case in which the evidence, this court affirmed a district judge's exclusion of a tape-recorded conversation. In that case, the defendant was the proponent of the evidence. And the grounds for exclusion were that the defendant himself had recorded this conversation, allegedly, and then altered it, or at least possibly altered it, by re-recording it the night before trial. And so in that case, the basis for exclusion was, this is not, we don't trust the mechanical device or the defendant himself creating this recording. That's not at all this case. And as this court has said repeatedly in the context of chain of custody, where the government has maintains possession of the CD, there's a presumption of regularity. There's no reason to doubt or suggest it had been tampered with.
But when was how much time had elapsed between when the technician did this and when the trial occurred?
Judge, if memory serves me right, it could have been as long as a year.
A year. So would this technician have any recollection of?
He himself did not testify. I'm sorry,
right.
Let me clarify.
So I'm just wondering, if he testified, what would he say? He couldn't say, oh, I remember that number. Yeah, I remember that.
I agree with that, Your Honor. And I think one of the problems I've had with the argument here is there's really no suggestion as to what the nature of cross-examination would have been of this, quote, missing witness. He's really not instrumental to this case in any way. And in fact, as I argued, the defense in this case was not, this is not Mr. Vetrano's voice. I mean, we're forgetting, once he lost the admissibility question, the Confrontation Clause question, he's certainly free to argue to the jury that there's some doubt as to whether this is Mr. Vetrano's voice. He didn't do that at all, because that wasn't the defense in this case at all. And that's why it goes into the harmless error analysis. I mean, even if this court found some Crawford problem here, you look at this in terms of the harmless error analysis in Turner 2, and in that case, because the argument there, again, that dealt with expert testimony regarding the substance of cocaine, that was found to be harmless because the defense in that case wasn't as to the substance. The defense was, I'm not the person that dealt it. I'm not the drug dealer. So, too, here, there was no argument that this isn't Mr. Vetrano's voice or that these the documents that were submitted were, in fact, legitimate. It was conceded by the defense that the document was fraudulent. The argument was the government failed to prove that Mr. Vetrano had any role in that, and that he was the one that created it. So I can't think of a more clear situation of harmless error. There's no error, and certainly given the wealth of other evidence in this case, any error was harmless. If there are no further questions, I'm prepared to rest on my briefs.
Thank you, Mr. Gianpietro.
Thank you.
Mr. Rosen?
Thank you, Your Honor. We don't know what the technician did. I mean, Mr. Fardell can come up there and say...
No, but this is so unreal. How would he remember anything? How would he remember what happened a year ago with one of...
Well, we don't know if he had any reports. We don't know if he had any notes. We don't know. That's one of the things that the court of Turner, they talked about, is the jury notes to review, anything of that nature. That's what happens in any sort of case like this where you get an expert a year later come in. They have notes. They have work product. They have that sort of thing. We don't have any of that here.
Well, his defendant's lawyer could ask for any documents relating to the voice recognition process, right?
Well,
did he
objected.
Ask for them?
He objected.
I don't know,
Your Honor. I didn't do this case of
trial. You're supposed to know what went on in the district court, even though you weren't the lawyer there.
I appreciate it, Your Honor. Whether he did or didn't, I didn't remember seeing any of those as part of the discovery that I got. But I do know that, once again, it's the government's burden of proof. They're the proponent of getting this in. And whether that would have come in or not, I don't think without the technician it would have been admissible anyway. So I think that they still don't know what the technician would know, his qualifications, his expertise.
Why would it be inadmissible? Suppose that they're required, that the technician or whoever is required to keep a record of all the phone conversations of inmates that were recorded. You know, you could ask for that. You wouldn't need the technician for that. That'd be a business record. It's admissible. You don't need any.
It would be a business record, but I think the government would still need to put that on so the jury could hear that. I don't think it really becomes the burden of the defendant to sit there and try to rebut that when the government, it's our position, the government would have to, it's their burden, since they want to get this material in, to get that and have that presented to the jury for us to cross-examination. I think that's what the Court of Appeal, this court said in, for example, Turner 2, said that the government gets that in, and then they have a right to cross-examine to see what's going on and see, look at the information, look at the notes, look at the work product to see what happened in this situation here, and that didn't happen here. We don't have any questions about issues, knowledge about the qualifications of this technician, what he did, anything of that nature. Mr. Farnell comes up there. There's never even a testimony that he observed these matters. Now, Y and Z were admitted for identification, but they clearly directly led to Exhibit 9, which was the two phone calls that got played. Now, as far as Mr. Villona is concerned, I think it's clear that it is contrary to the government. It is harm error. There is clearly harm. The only evidence that the government really had was some paperwork and Villona. They relied upon Villona because he was the main contact. And as we all know, that he didn't come forth until he basically got told either you come forth and help with us, as a typical snitch does, and he was the only one. And that clearly gave a great deal of issue with his credibility. He then basically comes forth, and the only evidence they had that really sort of pointed to him, to my client, was these two phone calls, which were, they could hear his voice. There was no fingerprints. He never gave a confession or anything of that nature. But I'm out of time, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Rudd. Were you appointed?
I was, Your Honor.
Okay, well, we thank you for your efforts. We thank Mr. Gianpietro as well.